Well, thank you for thank you all for being this morning and being here this morning to explore an aspect of the Dharma. Today I'm going to address a topic that I've been concerned about with for a long time. I found this a difficult talk to write, and quite honestly, I'm not even certain it qualifies as a teisho. I guess we'll find out. It's also going to be a little bit longer than usual, so please sit comfortably, keeping the back straight, of course, and feel free to change your posture unobtrusively when you feel the need. If I had to give this talk a name, I would call it In Praise of Uncertainty. This whole matter came to a head for me a few months ago at a meeting of some friends, like-minded practitioners, during a discussion about travel costs for those who lived far away. One of the participants expressed considerable distress over the carbon footprint involved in traveling long distances. This appeared to meet with agreement from just about everybody present. As most of you know, the term carbon footprint has entered the popular lexicon as a kind of measure of how much of the gas carbon dioxide is produced by various activities, and thus the supposedly the planetary impact of everything from an individual driving a car or riding a bus to a coal-fired power plant. Now, I harbor a deep skepticism about the entire grand narrative of human-caused global warming, or climate change, as it's being called these days. I followed the controversy on this subject pretty carefully for a few years now. I'm no climate scientist, and I do not have more than the most rudimentary grasp of how climate works. But I have studied and taught various aspects of science, mostly human biology, for many years. I think, or I hope, I have over the years acquired some ability to recognize statements and claims about scientific work that are reasonable as opposed to those which are not. So, at that gathering, I had to shoot off my mouth and offer a few words of heresy. I spoke up and made what I felt were some important points about the topic. First, the fact of long-term, irreversible global warming has not been established. In fact, global temperatures have actually gone down in the last 9 or 10 years. Second, that carbon dioxide has only a very minor effect on heat trapping by the Earth's atmosphere. And historically, carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere have lagged behind global temperatures, making it an effect rather than a cause. Third, human contributions to atmospheric carbon dioxide are minuscule compared to natural sources. And finally, the world climate is what is called a complex, coupled, nonlinear, chaotic system, impossible to predict with any accuracy beyond a few days. I also mentioned that while walking lightly on the earth and being mindful of one's use of resources is certainly important as a spiritual practice, one should not fall into the trap of thinking that by doing so, one is somehow saving the planet or having any measurable impact on it, whatever. The silence, as they say, was deafening. Well, we finally moved on, but the atmosphere was noticeably strained for a bit. So why am I saying all this? Why did I open my big mouth then, and why do I speak out here? Well, full disclosure, I was, to a very small extent, part of another one of these Earth in Peril myths, the result of which has been human suffering, horrific, almost beyond imagining. Way back in 1962, before many of you here were born, a book, The Silent Spring, was published. In it, the author, Rachel Carson, claimed that a particular insecticide, dichlorodiphenyl trichloroethane, better known as DDT, caused, among other things, several kinds of cancer, fatal thinning of the eggshells of wild birds, and that it threatened the extinction of many species of fish. Rachel Carson was a passionate and eloquent writer, and the book was hailed as a major contribution to environmental awareness. The controversy over DDT was a watershed. The elimination of all uses of DDT became a rallying cry for the early environmental movement. By the 1970s, the environmental lobby, made up of groups like the Sierra Club, the Environmental Defense Fund, and the World Wildlife Fund, had become a very powerful political force. At that time, I was a graduate student at UCLA, and along with most of my fellow students and even the faculty, I wrote letters, joined groups, and signed anti-DDT petitions. In 1972, William Ruckelshaus, who was then head of the Environmental Protection Agency, issued a total ban on the use of DDT for any purpose whatever in the United States. We all thought it was a great victory. But there was a problem. Rachel Carson was totally 180 degrees wrong in every single particular. Not one of her accusations against DDT has been borne out by subsequent research. A careful examination of her book reveals a pattern of misquotes, misunderstandings, and outright distortions of the science that was available even then. A thorough study by the National Science Foundation concluded that no adverse effects on humans or animals had ever been confirmed. Ruckelshaus himself admitted that his decision was a political one that had no relation to the known science about DDT. To my everlasting shame, I had bought into the propaganda. I didn't do the research. I didn't check the facts. I didn't want to hear or read anything contrary to what amounted to a blind faith in what I thought was settled science, that DDT was bad and represented everything bad about corporate agriculture and environmental pollution. It was only years later that I began to learn of the devastation that followed that victory. What I and many of my cohorts didn't bother to consider was that starting with its introduction in 1948, DDT was widely used in Africa to control the populations of mosquitoes, the carriers of malaria. The ban issued in the United States amounted to a worldwide ban because no other country manufactured DDT in large quantities, and African countries were bullied into discontinuing its use by threats from the U.S. and Europe that the import of agricultural products from any country that used DDT for anything would be banned. The rate of malarial infection in Africa, which had been reduced to nearly zero during the 20 years that DDT had been in use, began predictably to rise. Today, 1 to 2 million people a year die from malaria. It's difficult to find an exact number, but it has been estimated that over 60 million Africans have died of malaria since that ban took effect. Mostly they have been the very old and the very young. And this says nothing about the enormous economic and political impacts of a huge and growing population of people chronically ill and disabled from the disease. In a book entitled Eco-Imperialism, Green Power, Black Death, the author Paul Dreisen writes, "Where DDT is used, malaria deaths plummet. Where it is not used, they skyrocket. For example, in South Africa, the most developed nation on the continent, the incidence of malaria had been kept very low, below 10,000 cases annually, by the careful use of DDT. But in 1996, environmentalist pressure convinced program directors to cease using DDT. One of the worst epidemics in that country's history ensued, with almost 62,000 cases in the year 2000. Shortly after this peak, South Africa reintroduced DDT. In 1 year, malaria cases plummeted by 80%. In 2 years, they were almost back to the 10,000 cases per annum level. Next door, in Mozambique, which doesn't use DDT, malaria rates remain stratospheric. Similar experiences have been recorded in Zambia, other African countries, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, and elsewhere." That's the end of the Dreisen quote. Here is what the late J. Gordon Edwards, professor of entomology at San Jose State University, wrote. "From 1974 to 1977, the U.S. Export-Import Bank financed more than $3 billion of pesticides, saving millions of human lives. In 1977, environmental groups sued to force AID, that's the Agency for International Development, to ban exports of DDT, after which many countries could no longer obtain any. The World Bank extended $165 million to India's malaria sufferers, but specified that no DDT could be used. Dozens of other countries, where massive numbers of malaria deaths continue to occur, also cannot receive financial aid unless they agree not to control mosquitoes by using DDT. In 1986, Secretary of State George Shultz telegraphed orders to all embassies stating, quote, the U.S. cannot participate in programs using any of the following, lindane, BHC, DDT, or Deldrin. Millions of poor natives in tropical countries died as a result from starvation or from malaria or other insect-transmitted diseases. The term genocide is used in other contexts to describe such numbers of casualties." That's the end of the Edwards quote. Nevertheless, powerful lobbies like Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, Environmental Defense Fund and the World Wildlife Fund still continue to vociferously oppose any and all uses of DDT. And what a cost has been paid and continues to be paid by black Africans and others who are poor and politically powerless. At long last, the use of DDT is gradually increasing in Africa and elsewhere. Some countries have decided to defy the United States and Europe. And DDT is now being used not only in South Africa, but Uganda and Namibia. The World Health Organization has stopped its opposition to a very conservative program of indoor residual spraying. But, of course, it is too late for maybe 80 or 100 million people. However, the same people who are victims of the DDT ban will become victims of yet another catastrophic conceit of the environmental movement, the global warming grand narrative. People in developing countries who are in dire need of affordable energy, clean water, hospitals, schools, roads, in short, a decent life, are being denied their chance by the same activists who are now opposing the use of fossil fuels, the building of dams and other infrastructure, all in the name of saving the planet. The biggest cause of environmental damage is poverty. If you don't believe that, look at Haiti. The entire country has been totally denuded of trees by people desperately looking for firewood. Firewood. In an age of nuclear energy, hydroelectric energy, and yes, coal-fired power plants, people are still using the most polluting and dangerous common sources of energy, and that includes cow dung and old tires just to cook a meal, to survive. Somewhere between 2 and 5 million children die each year in Africa from respiratory diseases. Right now, we are seeing the consequences of the latest environmental fad, biofuels, which is diverting enormous amounts of land and resources from the production of food to the production of ethanol and palm oil, to the point where the world price of staples such as rice and other grains has more than doubled. Once again, it is the poor who are paying. Those who lived on the margin are now hungry. Those who were hungry are now starving in their millions. Closer to home, another myth that is gaining popularity and doing more and more damage is the myth of the so-called obesity epidemic, an irrational fear of fat that has no basis in fact. There is no evidence whatever that children are getting fatter, and no evidence that people with higher body mass indices are at risk for the whole laundry list of diseases that have been connected with it. In fact, it's turning out that a certain amount of body fat, even a large amount, is actually protective as we get older. Yet eating disorders are becoming more and more common, not just among teenage girls, but adults and even the elderly. Well-meaning parents and schools, especially in the UK, are literally starving children, and people are undergoing bariatric surgery in record numbers, all to meet a set of completely unrealistic and arbitrary goals of a so-called ideal body weight. Now, on any of these subjects, I could go through a long discussion about evidence, basic science, and so on, to discredit these and other myths. But what I've mentioned here are only examples of a more general phenomenon. They are only three of the many heads of the Hydra of ignorance and fear. This diatribe is not specifically about global warming, the global warming myth, or about DDT, or about the obesity myths. And I'm using the word myth here in a pejorative sense. There are myths that are wonderful and useful, like the myths around the Buddha's birth and teachings, and we recognize them as such. But there's something going on here that I have not seen directly addressed in the Buddhist literature. Maybe I've just missed it. I suppose one could call it the raising up of false gods. There seems to be a very deep need in all of us to have some kind of moral or spiritual certainty to hang on to. Some separate external god out there. A god to set up, worship, sacrifice to, and what is far worse, demand that others worship and sacrifice to it as well. So we have the god of the environment, the god of global climate, the gods of wellness and thinness, the god of organic food, the god of carbon credits, the god of the rainforest, and countless others. What I find really interesting is how the worshippers of God X react to opposition. There will, of course, be other gods, and the worshippers of God Y may well be in conflict with the worshippers of God X. And yet there is a kind of cordiality between them, an unspoken agreement that while your God and my God are in opposition, that's really okay. We can take prisoners, try to convert one another. The real enemy, the great Satan, is the one who questions, the one who says, wait a minute, let's look at the evidence, maybe even run some numbers. It is these people who are vilified, demonized, shot, burned at the stake. It is not surprising that a primary target of terrorist organizations and warring factions in the Middle East and elsewhere are the journalists. It is the journalist's job to question, to look for evidence, to ferret out the truth of what's going on. And as such, they are a far greater threat than the avowed enemy. So, is there a Dharma point in all this mess? The Buddha said, do not believe in anything simply because you have heard it. Do not believe in anything simply because it is spoken and rumored by many. Do not believe in anything simply because it is found written in your religious books. Do not believe in anything merely on the authority of your teachers and elders. Do not believe in traditions because they have been handed down for many generations. But after observation and analysis, when you find that anything agrees with reason and is conducive to the good and benefit of one and all, then accept it and live up to it. If the Buddha were around today, he might well add something like, do not believe in anything simply because you have seen it on television or read it in the newspapers. Do not believe in anything simply because someone says studies have shown or the science is settled. Do not believe in anything simply because politicians declare it to be so. No wonder Zen Buddhism is not a popular religion. It raises questions. We spend our time on and off the mat questioning, examining, evaluating, and reevaluating every aspect of our lives. We try as best we can to live up to the Buddha's admonition as regards our formal practice. We try to see the false gods for what they are and let them go. But this is a very subtle business. And as much as we do this in matters we consider spiritual and maybe psychological in our own individual lives and practice, we seem to be much more willing to accept false gods when they are presented to us under the guise of science. Too often we accept without any serious question that which we are told by experts. We have to apply the same skepticism expressed by the Buddha to every part of our lives. Skepticism, questioning, is practice. Do not believe in anything simply because you have heard it, or read it, or saw it on TV. It is surprising how the very first opinion that we hear about anything tends to stick with us, and any subsequent dissenting opinion or questions is resisted, regardless of the evidence. There is a saying that a lie is halfway around the world before truth even gets its boots on. Do not believe in anything simply because it is spoken and rumored by many. It's common knowledge. Everybody knows it. They all say it. Everybody's doing it. There seems to be an inborn herd instinct or tribal instinct that encourages us to go along with the crowd, something we see demonstrated in mass panic situations, riots, rock concerts, military situations where normally decent people do outrageous things, even commit atrocities. But more subtly, when we hear that a petition has been signed by X thousands of people, or that X number of scientists predict something, it is a very powerful attraction. The number of people who believe in anything is completely irrelevant to the fact. The author Michael Crichton said, "If it is consensus, then it is not science. If it is science, it is not consensus." Do not believe in anything merely on the authority of your teachers and elders. Well, person X says it, and he or she is a Nobel Prize winner, a Pulitzer Prize winner, Mother Teresa, Albert Schweitzer, the Pope, the Dalai Lama, the Buddha. The one thing that the Buddha didn't want was for people to follow his path simply because he told them to. His admonitions were always for each of us to work out our own salvation. Yes, when our teachers recommend a course of action, we do it to the best of our ability, but only to the point where we can rely on our own experience. The Buddha said that even his Dharma, his teaching, is provisional. Do not believe in traditions because they have been handed down for many generations. Well, we're not likely to fall into that trap when we are talking about nuclear physics. But there is something about phrases like the wisdom of the ages, or the wisdom of the answers, of the ancestors, that is very seductive. I have a habit of quoting at great length from the writings of the ancient masters, including the sayings of the Buddha. I like to think that it is because I have found my own experience to be in accord. But maybe I'm just trying to convince all of you by appeal to authority. None of this is about rejecting outright. It is just that we are not to take on beliefs for these reasons alone. When we find that our beliefs or principles are in conflict with teachings or sayings or a newspaper article or a series on television. It's important to examine both. But after observation and analysis, when you find that anything agrees with reason and is conducive to the good and benefit of one and all, then accept it and live up to it. Observation, analysis, reason. Not words one often associates with religion. In fact, to many, they have the smack of blasphemy. Observation, the careful, detailed looking at what is. It is not easy to winnow out what is genuine observation of reality from our thoughts, opinions, preconceptions, and prejudices about reality. But is this not an aspect of our zazen, to sit and see clearly beyond the ego mind to the deepest reality? Analysis and reason. The intellect, the cold, analytical part of ourselves, is not to be ignored. We have the right, the obligation, in fact, to use our education, our training in whatever field of endeavor, whatever logical skills we have, whatever experience we have, to the very best of our ability. We have the obligation to look carefully, reason it out, think about our own direct experience in the matter. Look for reason and the good and benefit of one and all. The good and benefit of one and all. Did we get that? The good and benefit of one and all, not just for those with a particular political, economic, or environmental outlook, and certainly not just those of us who live in the United States or other privileged parts of the world. Scientific research and spiritual practice are very similar in that they are both about seeing the world as it is. This means a continuous re-examination and revisiting of old thoughts and notions, a continuous revision and dropping of stuff, and let's face it, sometimes serious embarrassment. Oh, wow, did I ever get that one wrong? This is the dropping away of the self. As we do this, the false gods drop away as well, because they are part of this separate, illusory self. They buttress the self. But even as we let go of false gods, new ones pop up. It is a continuous process. The less attached we are to the notion of self, the less likely we are to get it caught up by the next fad, the next god. These days we hear a great media blitz to the effect that the world is about to go up in flames due to human-generated carbon dioxide. We are bombarded by opinions of those who are introduced as experts who declare that if immediate and drastic action is not taken, the seas will rise and inundate low-lying coastal areas all over the world. Islands will disappear and all the polar bears will drown. Do not believe in anything simply because you have heard it. Do not believe in anything simply because it is spoken and rumored by many. Moral or intellectual certainty about something is no guarantee. Not in science, not in our practice, not in what you read in the papers or see on television. What we generally think of as personal experience is no guarantee. Sincerity is no guarantee. The most convincing of deceivers is the self-deceived. The physicist Richard Feynman once said to a graduating class of Caltech, The first principle is that you must not fool yourself. And you are the easiest person to fool. So you have to be very careful about that. Yes, we have to be careful. And yet we have to live. We all want to do the right thing. We all want the earth to survive in decent condition for whoever comes next. It's very possible to feel helpless in the face of contradictory opinions on a difficult and abstruse subject. If we don't have the skills and education to evaluate for ourselves, are we left with no choice but to believe those who are presented as authorities? What is the practice issue here? Is there a practice issue? Dogen said there is no gap between practice and enlightenment, or zazen and daily life. So, in daily life then, when faced with news stories, pronouncements from sources I am not familiar with, or about something where my own knowledge is limited, here's what I look for. It's not infallible, but it helps. One thing I think we all learn after a while in our practice is a degree of humility. What is this humility? It is a willingness to look at the world as it is, without sentimentality or wishful thinking. To assess carefully the results of one's own actions, with a thorough understanding of the law of unintended consequences, otherwise known as the law of karma. The mind, the earth, societies, humanity, it's complex beyond imagining. Respect that. Respect your own ignorance. How do we do this? Look for the contrary argument. Look for that which challenges you. Look for that which might make you uncomfortable. Above all, look for uncertainty. Look carefully at how each god is presented. Is there total certainty, conviction, passion? The more strident the argument, the more dire the predictions, the greater the sacrifices demanded, the more vicious the attacks on those who doubt or ask for evidence, the more suspicious I get. This is not to say that experts never disagree. Of course they do. That's part of the process. But there has to be that humility, the willingness to listen to the other, to change one's opinion in the light of new observations. And maybe even more important, it's okay not to know. It's okay not to have an opinion. I could not render any opinion whatever on a new mathematical presentation of string theory. But that doesn't mean that I am obliged to accept someone else's opinion on the matter just because they have one. And again, consider training. What is the training and education of someone who is making pronouncements about the environment, global warming, or whatever? Marcus Aurelius said, "The opinion of 10,000 men is of no value if none of them knows anything about the subject." Someone else said that some people will do anything to save the earth, except take a science course. In our practice, it is said that we go to the one who knows. How do we recognize one who knows? I am a student of Dainin Henry Roshi because I know that he has undergone thorough and rigorous training with his teachers. Those teachers underwent thorough and rigorous training with their teachers, and so on, back and back and back. We insist that our physicians, engineers, airline pilots, massage therapists, our spiritual guides undergo training and have some kind of documentation of that training. Do we give a free pass to the people on television or on the radio about subjects like environment or climate? Those who have been denigrated and smeared as global warming deniers are among some of the most eminent climate scientists in the business, professors and researchers at major interest institutions who have published literally thousands of papers in the peer-reviewed literature, have spent their lives studying every aspect of climate with rigor and dedication. What are the qualifications of Al Gore? Where is his degree in climatology, geophysics, biogeography, fluid dynamics, statistical analysis, atmospheric physics or chemistry? Okay, I've gotten into trouble by naming names before, so I won't do it again. If someone tells me what I should do to save the rainforest, I would ask, can you name 10 species of tree that inhabit the Amazon basin? 10 species of bird that inhabit the canopy? 10 species of saprophytic plants? 10 species of insects? Can you coherently describe their interactions? If it is an impressive sounding organization, I would ask, who is on your research staff? How many peer-reviewed papers have they published that are directly related to the subject? If someone tells me there is an obesity epidemic, I would ask, name 5 hormones that are directly impact body weight. What part of the brain is most directly in control of the appetite? You cannot save anything unless you are intimately familiar with it. We speak of enlightenment as intimacy. Intimacy is not a matter of fuzzy good feelings or some oceanic feeling of oneness. It is not a matter of an emotional reaction to some abstract, meaningless term like the environment or the planet or the rainforest. Intimacy is a matter of hard work, study, looking carefully at minute details and puzzling out how they fit together. A major tenet of Buddhism is the principle of not harming. It is deep intimacy in the most hard-headed sense that prevents harm. It requires a degree of knowledge to even ask the important questions. Had I been more familiar with the legitimate uses of DDT and the lives it was saving, I would never have supported a ban. And again, do they walk the walk? Does someone who advocates that we all have to give up driving cars and use bicycles and public transport and generally downsize our lives, nevertheless, him or herself live a riotously extravagant life, jetting from country to country to conference after conference and lecture after lecture, and living in a house whose energy requirements are about the same as the average small town? Maybe there's a question here. The tremendous moral force of the writing and speaking of Mahatma Gandhi came largely from the fact that he himself lived the simplest possible life. And again, where is the compassion? When a proposal is put forth that frankly predicts and even advocates a stagnation or a drastic reduction in the economies of struggling third world peoples, is there a question? When you hear statements glorifying squalor and misery because of those color photos in the National Geographic, is there a question? When someone says words to the effect that there are too many people and that a ban on DDT is as good a way as any to control the population, is it just me Or does that sound slightly uncompassionate? Has anyone talked to those struggling people? Ask them how they want to live, how they want their children to live. The one central fact of all scientific enterprise, of all life, is uncertainty. There is never a final answer. Never has, never will be. Buzzwords like scientific consensus or the science is settled are danger signs. The greatest danger is knowing, certainty. So much of the suffering that we see in the world is a cost that results from certainty, from the failure to look carefully, to question, to seek and continue to seek. A cost that results from the sudden and unconsidered embracing of an idea and acting as if no other truth were possible. Please, remain uncertain. Do not believe in anything simply because you have heard it. Do not believe in anything simply because it is spoken and rumored by many. Do not believe in anything simply because it is found written in your religious books. Do not believe in anything merely on the authority of your teachers and elders. Do not believe in traditions because they have been handed down for many generations. But after observation and analysis, when you find that anything agrees with reason and is conducive to the good and benefit of one and all, then accept it and live up to it. Together with all beings, we realize Buddhahood.